Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 157 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. You can listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm or download the MP3 after broadcast on iTunes or similar podcast aggregators. You can listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. You'll be responsible for any long-distance charges. Remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. I also love to know about potential guests you'd like or topics you'd like covered. If you'd like to sponsor this show, please contact me. You can donate via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com or see theinfectiousmyth.com/donate.php. If you want to make regular donations, please go to patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Even a few dollars a month helps. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you're gleaning, for the support you get for some of your non-mainstream ideas, and challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. Now for some feedback. Adelphio was listening to episode 149, which was my interview with Charles Ortleb, publisher of the New York Native back in the 1980s and 90s, among many other accomplishments. Adelphio said, "Today I listened to the 25th of July podcast. Great show as usual. Keep up the great work." Ray, on the other hand, didn't like it when I used the term people of color. What the hell does that stupid phrase mean? Maybe there are transparent people made of glass whom I haven't seen for obvious reasons. But everyone from the fairest in Scandinavia to the blackest in wherever has color. As an aside, let me, not Ray, me, explain the concept of words to you. A word has a meaning and it cannot be taken literally. Someone noted once that we drive on parkways and park on driveways, yet everyone knows what that term means. In Chinese, panda is literally bear cat, but it's just a word. When you say it, people don't think bear plus cat, they just think panda. People know what people of color means. Maybe it's not a perfect term, but it's probably less clumsy than non-white. And of course, white people aren't perfectly white either, unless they're albino. So he continues, Ray continues, "You progressives, lefties, Marxists are a sick bunch, denying the reality of all evidence that challenges your totally arbitrary dogma. For example, that regardless of race or sex, we are almost interchangeable. Nonsense. I hope the president of Google has to hire 6 white female programmers or 12 black to replace the 1 white male he fired because he had the audacity to openly state an obvious but not politically correct fact." Well, this is David again, not Ray. That's a pretty obnoxious statement. I've been a programmer myself, and if there's any difference between genders or races, it's extremely small. It's certainly not 6-to-1 or 12-to-1. And it could be that some genders and races on average actually have slightly better capabilities on average than white men, but that doesn't say anything about an individual. Anyway, you won't catch me saying that men and women are interchangeable. I actually talked about biological differences, such as the fact that only biological women can carry a baby and nurse the baby, and this has consequences. As a generalization, I believe it creates a stronger bond between mother and baby, on average, than between father and baby, and there's certainly lots of counterexamples. There's mothers that one day just get up and leave baby with dad and disappear. It's a lot more common with fathers. But again, these are only generalizations and really have very little applicability to an individual case. As I said, I'm not going to say men and women are identical when it comes to computer programming or anything else. I've worked with women programmers and with engineers from just about every country in the world. And I think, although there may be differences in some aspects based on the educational systems, cultures, maybe a little bit of genetics, the differences are very small, not necessarily all in favor of white men. And the mixture of people from different cultures, genders, backgrounds, etc., actually is a benefit, which is generally not considered. So if you have a mixture of men and women and people from all over the world in a team, you're probably going to get better results than if everybody came from the same town, they're all straight white men. Anyway, I thought Ray's comments overall were kind of ridiculous, so I won't make you suffer through the rest of them, but just an example of some of the comments that I get. Not everything I get is telling me that I'm doing a great job. But if you think that I'm doing a great job, even just a short message to say so would be great. And if you don't think I'm doing a great job, I find that interesting. I do have a sense of humor. Maybe I should finish with his last paragraph. You people support ending housing discrimination, but in the real world, robins fly with robins, sparrows with sparrows, and lions with lions. Actually, I didn't think lions flew, but I have seen lions with wings in some ancient temples. Lions don't socialize with deer, they eat them. And they don't first consider that the mummy deer may have been looking for food for her babies. Learn from nature. Most of the violence in the world is because we deny reality and pretend humans are more civilized, contrary to the history of human wars and atrocities to each other. Okay, back to David. I cannot make any sense of this paragraph, so I'm just going to assume that it's poetry. And thanks, Ray, for sending me a thought-provoking poem. And then Ray concluded. Okay, I said I wasn't going to read any more, but here's his last paragraph. And then it gets dark again, but I think I've wasted enough of your time. Finally, we get to agree on something, Ray. I wasn't planning to talk about guns today, but then Las Vegas happened. The massacre at the Country Music Festival in Las Vegas by one man, apparently, Stephen Paddock. As I'm recording this, 59 people have already died, 527 injured, and those numbers may go up. And apparently, so far, they found 42 guns plus explosives that he had. It appeared that he was using automatic weapons. One of the responses, well, there are many responses when there is a gun massacre like that, like this. One of them is we shouldn't talk about it for a while. But after a few days, maybe there's another one, and then we shouldn't talk about it because there's been another one, or something else has happened that distract our attention away, so it never seems to get talked about. Nothing gets done. Another thing is, what we need is more good guys with guns when there's a bad guy with guns. But this is actually a really good example. Imagine that you were in that crowd of thousands of people and you wanted to do something. So you're looking across the street at a long distance at the Mandalay Bay Hotel. How would you know exactly where to fire the weapon? And at that distance, how would you know that you wouldn't go into a neighboring room and kill an innocent person in a room above or below or to the side of the murderer? How could you possibly be so good at firing that you would hit just him? Even if you could hit his window, the chances of hitting him, who's safely ensconced behind the wall of hotel room acting as a barrier, it would be virtually impossible. Plus, you've just picked up a gun and started firing it, so everybody would assume that you're the murderer, because most people probably didn't realize that the gunshots probably had no idea at first where the gunshots were coming from. In the panic, you can imagine the screaming, people collapsing, blood everywhere. How would people have had the presence of mind to stop, see where this person is firing from? And even if you did want to do that, you're now directly in the line of fire, so it's just a matter of random chance whether you're one of the people who gets killed or not. Some people have said it must have been the work of a leftist, but that the assumption has been that it's an extreme right white conservative because he kind of fits that profile, but we don't really know too much about him. It may turn out that he had left-wing political views like Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, or maybe he wasn't politically motivated at all. He just was crazy and wanted to kill people and didn't really care. Was there a political motivation for this? He was shooting probably at mostly white people. It's hard to see exactly what the political motivation was, but maybe that will come out in the future. But does it really matter? The problem is guns, not the motivation for the guns. If it had been a religious fanatic, obviously religion would have helped understand the motivations, but the fact that he could kill so many people was due to the gun. In Canada, a couple of days before this, there was a man with murder on his mind, a Somali immigrant, who rented a van and drove into a crowd. He had a knife. He started stabbing people. He didn't manage to kill anybody. Now, it's quite likely that if things had turned out a little differently, he could have killed a few people, but there's no way that he could have killed 59 people and injured 527. It's only really the possession of powerful guns that can do this. The Republicans had on the agenda to approve a law that would make it easier to possess silencers and to transfer guns between states without licenses. It's not clear that either of these things would have made any difference in the Stephen Paddock case, but again, that's kind of irrelevant. There have been many, many loosenings of gun control laws in America, and each one of them plays a role in some of the mass shootings, and none of them probably play a role in all of them. In the International Business Times, there was an article regarding two of the top politicians in Nevada being some of the NRA's most favorite people. It's an article by David Sirota. Nevada's most powerful Democrat and Republican played pivotal roles in blocking the government from regulating assault weapons. Both Nevada's longtime U.S. Senator Harry Reid, a Democrat, and Republican Nevada Governor Brian Sandoval have been lauded by gun rights groups for making sure people can easily purchase deadly weapons in a state where, quote, no permit is required to purchase most firearms, according to the state's legislature. The National Rifle Association in 2009 praised Reid for using his position as Senate Majority Leader to block the effort to reinstate the 1994 ban on assault weapons after it had been allowed to expire in 2004. On his campaign website, Harry Reid bragged about the NRA's support for his move to stop the assault weapons ban and listed other ways he'd helped try to minimize the ban. Those include previous votes to kill an amendment to the Federal Death Penalty Act, which added 12 specific assault weapons to the list, and his votes against legislation to ban the manufacture, sale, and possession of 19 semi-automatic assault weapons and copycat guns. His campaign website also touted the Democrats' support for initiatives to preempt local gun regulations. In 2010, for example, he signed a legal brief pressing the Supreme Court to invalidate Chicago's gun ordinances. Bill O'Reilly really distinguished himself. This is his message of the day for October 2nd, 2017. It's short, so I'll read the whole thing. Once again, the big downside of American freedom is on gruesome display. A psychotic gunman in Las Vegas has committed the worst mass murder in U.S. history. 64-year-old Stephen Paddock, who lived in Nevada, began firing from a hotel window about 10 p.m. Pacific time last night. His targets were folks attending a music festival below him. When it was all over, more than 50 human beings lay dead, 400 plus wounded. He apparently killed himself as police closed in. He had a number of deadly weapons in his room, and you can count on the gun control debate to ramp up. But having covered scores of gun-related crimes over the years, I can tell you that government restrictions will not stop psychopaths from harming people. They will find a way. Public safety demands logical gun laws, but the issue is so polarizing and emotional that little will be accomplished as there's no common ground. The NRA and its supporters want easy access to weapons, while the left wants them banned. This is the price of freedom. Violent nuts are allowed to roam free until they do damage, no matter how threatening they are. The Second Amendment is clear that Americans have a right to arm themselves for protection, even the loons. Let's analyze this a little bit, go back over some of his words. Government restrictions will not stop psychopaths from harming people. Well, they did in Australia. In 1996, it was the last straw when I believe 35 people were killed at a popular national park in Tasmania by a mentally disturbed person. And I'm not saying all people who kill are mentally disturbed. I think that's kind of irrelevant, but the fact is some people will kill. The Conservative government of Australia at that time took the very difficult step of severely restricting guns in Australia. They did it at great political risk to themselves. It was a very brave move considering their political stance on the right of the political spectrum. But they did it, and since then there have not been mass shootings. There have been no mass shootings in Australia since 1996, since they restricted guns. In England, it was a very similar story. Bill O'Reilly also says there's no common ground. The NRA and its supporters want easy access to weapons while the left wants them banned. Well, there is common ground. It's called common sense. There are probably some people on the left who want guns banned. But I certainly could see that there are legitimate uses for guns. I'm not a gun user myself, but I'm not going to press for all guns to be eliminated. But some guns seem to have no reason for existence except to kill people. Powerful weapons that can shoot hundreds of yards, as were obviously used in the slaughter in Las Vegas. Large magazines, which means that you don't have to reload for a long time, so you can kill many people before pausing to reload, which is the point at which many murders are overpowered by people around them. Once people see that the person is trying to put another magazine in, they have a few seconds where they can jump him. So it makes a huge difference. The silencers that the U.S. Congress is going to vote on pretty soon can also make it easier to kill more people. Depending on the circumstances, it makes it more difficult to see where the shooter is. It may not have had any impact in this case because they do reduce the range of firing, but every gun massacre is a little bit different. They all have different characteristics and different ways to approach them, and the solutions that apply to each massacre are slightly different. Taking the Second Amendment, let's read it. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. I've never really fully understood the grammar of this sentence. But the NRA doesn't like to talk about the well-regulated militia part. Somebody who is a supporter of gun rights, I would say a gun rights extremist, said that how you have to read it is that everybody gets to have guns because it's from that group of people, the ordinary civilians with guns, from which you get the militia. That may be, but that's hardly a well-regulated militia. A well-regulated militia is not a random group of people who choose whether or not to have guns, from which, when there's a problem, when there's a potential invasion by another country, you pick people to form your well-regulated militia. Take countries that do have well-regulated militias, which are often used as examples of how having lots of guns is not a problem. Switzerland and Israel, both recently have regulated their militia. So if you're a member of the military in Switzerland or Israel, you probably cannot take your gun home, because in both countries they discovered that too many people were committing suicide or committing domestic violence with their guns. So now you need to have a reason. If you live in an area in Israel that is considered too dangerous, you may be able to take the gun home, but in most parts of the country, you cannot. In a way, I feel for people like Bill O'Reilly. They've positioned themselves on the right of the political spectrum, and on the right of the political spectrum, you have to support all gun rights. And there really is no room for a middle ground for them, but there is for ordinary, sane people. Let's talk about, for example, one more thing, the right to arm themselves. In America, you don't have the right to arm yourself with a fully automatic weapon, although you can easily convert a semi-automatic weapon to automatic, and you can buy things that make a semi-automatic weapon almost an automatic weapon. But you don't have the right to buy a bazooka or a tank or a nuclear bomb. The Second Amendment doesn't say that the right of the people to keep and bear guns shall not be infringed. It says arms. Because back then, that's mostly what arms were. Even then, there were military arms, and I suppose nobody thought that a colonist in the 1700s would want to get a cannon or something like that. So you could easily interpret the Second Amendment to say, yeah, if you want a cannon, why not? And a cannon attached to a vehicle, which is a tank, why not? Why not bombs? Why not nuclear bombs? If you interpret the Second Amendment in a completely literal way, then everybody in America has the right to have any kind of arm. So the right to bear arms has not been infringed in the sense that you can't bear some arms, but the type of arms needs to be well regulated. It is regulated, but I would say that it's not well regulated. When you can buy guns that one person can kill 59 people with and injure 527 within the space of 10 minutes, there is no real reason for that. Who needs to go hunting with that powerful weaponry? One of the musicians changed his mind about gun control. Caleb Keeter was a guitarist on stage when the shooting started. He survived, but he tweeted a message saying, "I've been a proponent of the Second Amendment my entire life. Until the events of last night, I cannot express how wrong that I was." He pointed out that several of his crew members were licensed to carry guns, and they actually had guns with them. But what good did it do? As I pointed out, nobody with guns in a crowd of thousands when one person is shooting from a hotel across the street could have possibly done anything. Caleb tweeted again, "We need gun control right now. My biggest regret is that I stubbornly didn't realize it until my brothers on the road and myself were threatened by it." Reaction was kind of mixed. There were people in favor of gun control who were not very sympathetic. "While I'm glad you and yours are alive, it took a personal assault to change your mind. It's called empathy. You had none until today." Another person pointed out that during the Newtown massacre, children were mowed down in their classroom, six-year-olds. "That didn't convince you? You had to feel the pain yourself before you did anything." On the other hand, people in favor of gun rights were tweeting, "Gun control wouldn't have stopped the shooter. You're watching too much alt-left CNN. Another, "Sorry, cannot agree with you. You're speaking out of ignorance in your emotions." Other people were grateful. "Praise the guy for learning. Don't give him a hard time. This event will be burned in the memory of all the survivors as well as the rest of the world. One of these days, it will become apparent that if we change nothing, we cannot expect change. Maybe this time, maybe it will take another dozen mass shootings. But when a baby step is taken towards prevention, take it." Another, "Thank you. It takes courage to admit your feelings in the face of the ugly crap you're going to get. Hang in there. Also, a good article by John Cassidy in the New Yorker, Las Vegas, Gun Violence, and the Failing American State. I pointed out, I stated on my Facebook page that I wasn't going to talk about thoughts and prayers because all the politicians had already beaten me to it, and that was just a cover for doing nothing. Somebody at the White House briefing on Monday, a reporter asked Sarah Huckabee Sanders whether the shooting had, quote, made the president think anything more about pursuing tighter gun laws to prevent massacres like this. Sanders replied, there's a time and place for political debate, but now is the time to unite as a country. In response to follow-up questions, Sanders said, one of the things we don't want to do is to try to create laws that won't stop these types of things from happening. I think if you look to Chicago, where you've had over 4,000 victims of gun-related crimes last year, they have the strictest gun laws in the country, which, as an aside, is true, but the problem is that they're very close to places that are not Chicago, either in Illinois or other states, so it's very easy to bring guns into the city. Paul Ryan asked for the flags of the U.S. Capitol to be flown at half-mast, which is probably all that he's going to do. Mitch McConnell asked for national mourning and for prayer, which is probably all he's going to do. Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader, asked for the establishment of a bipartisan select committee on gun violence to study and report common sense legislation to help end the crisis. I'm sure that's not going to happen as long as the Republicans are in control, and there's probably enough Democrats who will also either not vote or will vote against such a thing because they're also in the pockets of the NRA. The article talks about the, quote, Sportsman's Heritage and Recreational Enhancement Act of 2017, which he accurately describes as a carefully misnamed piece of legislation, which is designed to make it easier to import assault rifles, transport weapons across state lines, and purchase silencers. This has been restricted since the 30s because gangsters loved them. I think this legislation would have been passed lickety-split, but the Las Vegas massacre has put a little bit of a crimp in the plans of the gun fanatics in Congress. To close on these articles, it's interesting to me that the Second Amendment seems to take precedence over everything else. I think there's something in the Constitution about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, it's one of the great things about America. There's so much freedom. But what does that freedom mean if you go out to a concert, to enjoy some music, to be with your spouse, your partner, your friends, your children, and randomly people are dying around you? Where's the freedom in that? Where's the freedom in the First Amendment, the freedom of speech, when there's somebody with a gun? In the Charlottesville situation, there was, with the demonstrations by neo-Nazis, there was an article written by a Jewish person, I don't know if he was a rabbi or somehow connected with the synagogue, who stated that during the Charlottesville rally, there were a couple of people armed with what looked like military weapons standing outside the synagogue during a service. Now, to a lot of people, part of freedom of speech is the freedom to practice your religion. It's a form of speech. How is there freedom when you're threatened implicitly by somebody with a gun? You're not just threatened when somebody uses a gun. You're threatened when somebody is around you with a gun. There have been gun proponents who have deliberately gone to restaurants where gun control advocates have been meeting just to walk around with guns. I think in Canada, if somebody walked into a restaurant with what looked like a military weapon, everybody would run out screaming. In most countries, I'm sure in most of Europe, the same thing would happen. It's hard to believe that in America, this is considered normal. It's not normal, and it has to change. As Bill O'Reilly pointed out, you don't really know that this person's a bad guy until they pick the gun up and start firing it. So Americans are supposed to allow the bad guy to walk into the store, walk around, take up a position, and only when they pull the trigger can you actually do anything. It seems that if you really want life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, you would ask that people be polite enough not to bring deadly weapons into public spaces. And if they want to use deadly weapons, they use them safely. They're trained. They use them for legitimate purposes, like hunting, for example, or target shooting. And that when their guns are not in use, they are carefully stored in a locked safe with the ammunition stored in a separate place, etc., etc. Now, just to prove that I'm not a closet leftist, let's talk about Title IX. This is the discussion over sexual assault on campus. I'm no fan of Betsy DeVos. I think she wants to privatize American education and basically create good education for the rich and really bad education for those who can't afford to get out of the public system. But in this case, Betsy DeVos is correct. I don't know exactly how it became necessary to deal with sexual assault on campuses differently than just about anywhere else. In the work site, in the military, normally the handling of sexual assault would be to call the police. It's a crime, and the police should handle it. Now, it's very true that the police in the past have not handled sexual assault well at all, but they are the people who in the end need to handle it. Even on a campus, if there's going to be criminal charges, it's going to go through the police. So we need to work on getting the police at better handling sexual assault, on making sure that they handle the person who's accused somebody else of sexual assault respectfully, that they get the necessary samples so that charges could potentially be laid, that they interview witnesses, they do a good job, that they don't dismiss the cases because they don't think it will necessarily go through. We don't want a situation like recently happened in India, where a woman who was drunk said that she said no several times, and she held her arms to try to prevent a man from removing her clothes and having sex with her, but he persisted. In court, it was stated that it was a feeble no, so maybe that was the same as a yes. And so the charges of rape were dropped. I don't think we want to be there. Rape is a crime and needs to be dealt with as a crime. The problem with Title IX, and Betsy DeVos has recognized this along with many other people, is that it has caused massive problems of justice for the accused people. The Washington Post has an article in a section called Perspectives by Dana Bulger and Alexandra Brodsky, who are co-directors of an organization called Know Your Nine, a reference to Title IX, described by the Washington Post as a national youth-led campaign against sexual violence in schools. They stated that to an invitation-only audience at George Mason University, close to the students who protested her expected announcement outside, she declared that the Obama administration had gone too far, protecting student survivors to the detriment of the accused. The education department, she indicated, will reverse course through a technical process called notice and comment. If that sounds innocuous, it's not. It's a signal that the Trump administration will make way for what is nothing less than an all-out attack on survivors. Well, the question is, did the Obama administration go too far protecting survivors to the detriment of the accused? Their comments about notice and comment are a bit strange because that's how the government makes changes to legislation. So yes, it's an indication the government wants to make changes, but it's nothing nefarious. Even if the change is innocuous, that's the process that goes through. You first notify the public that you're intending to rethink something, you receive comments from the public, and then you make your determination. That's the standard process that most regulations and legislation in the United States are done through in a lot of other countries as well. What does this famous Dear Colleague letter from 2011 say? It was from the United States Department of Education, April 4th, 2011, under the Obama administration. It was talking about sexual violence, which they called a form of sex discrimination, which is a little bit strange because sexual violence is a crime, not really sex discrimination, but they're trying to put it into the category of sexual discrimination. They specifically talk about people incapable of giving consent due to the victim's use of drugs or alcohol. There's a bit of a problem here because in many colleges where young people are getting together, they've maybe not had sex before. This is the first time for many of them. There's also maybe the first time that they've overused drugs or alcohol now that they're away from home and they don't have mom and dad looking over their shoulders. The problem is that both men and women use drugs or alcohol. So in the case where both are somewhat incapacitated, can they give consent? My understanding is you can give consent as long as you're able to give consent. Even if you're drunk, you can still give consent. But if you're incapacitated, you can't. So if somebody is semi-conscious, such as possibly in the Indian case, they're not capable of giving consent. But if you're capable of having a conversation, even if you're not making a lot of sense, you may very well be capable of giving consent. It requires, you could have a situation where both people are at the point where neither of them should be consenting to sex, but they do anyway. Who initiated it? Who was more drunk? How do you determine who's the more drunk? Is it the quantity of alcohol in their body? Do you have to take body weight into capacity, their individual genetic capacity to metabolize alcohol? How do you determine in the case where two people are having sex, who's more incapacitated? The general, rather Victorian assumption is that men always initiate sex and women decide whether to allow it or not, resulting in men being seen almost always as the aggressor, especially when the woman has been drinking, regardless of the state of alcohol consumption and sobriety of the man. In the well-documented so-called John Doe case at Occidental College in Los Angeles, it was written about by Richard Dormant in Esquire magazine in 2015, as well as by several other authors, including Emily Yaffe. The man appeared to be more drunk than the woman, and the woman, according to some witnesses, appeared to be the one initiating sex. The woman was clearly enthusiastic about having sex with this man who can't be named in this lawsuit, nor can the woman. She texted him asking him if he had a condom, texted him saying that she was coming to his room, and texted her friend, "I'm going to have sex now." However, after she sobered up, especially after she worked with Title IX counselors, she decided it was not consensual, initiated a Title IX procedure, which resulted in the man being kicked out of the college, and then what followed was a big lawsuit because clearly his rights to a fair trial or a pseudo trial in the case of Title IX procedures were violated. But that's maybe not the major problem of Title IX. I think a lot of critics of Title IX believe that where it really gets into trouble is in what is called the preponderance of evidence standard to evaluate complaints. It is mandatory, according to this letter, that a school uses this level of evidence. They describe the preponderance of evidence standard as saying it is more likely than not that the sexual harassment or violence occurred. So in other words, there needs to be a 51% probability that sexual harassment or violence occurred. They note that this is different than the clear and convincing standard, i.e. it is highly probable or reasonably certain that the sexual harassment or violence occurred. This, which they say is currently used by some schools, is a higher standard of proof. They're explicitly stating that schools will lose funding if they use the higher standard of proof. So you have a situation where there's been an accusation of some kind of sexual harassment or violence. And all you need to prove is it's slightly more likely than not that it occurred, which would never fly in, luckily, in a criminal case. One could say highly probable, what would you say, 80 or 90% probability that sexual harassment or violence occurred. And the problem is that there have been numerous cases where charges through this Title IX procedure have been brought forth. A young man has been thrown out of university. Usually life is made so difficult that they either have to leave or find it extremely difficult to continue their education. This, of course, can have lifetime consequences if somebody can't complete their education, which, of course, if they're a rapist, we don't care about, but what if they're not? Generally, what happens is the young man leaves the school or is kicked out and then sues and wins because the process has many aspects that are unjust. The schools have interpreted this. Maybe the letter didn't enforce this, but the schools are so concerned about losing their funding that they've weighed the system too much towards the accuser, so that there has been clear injustices against the young men. Usually, in these cases, it's a woman bringing the charge and a man being accused. Let's go to an example. The Washington Post in August had an article by Professor Johnson from Brooklyn College. He talked about what's called the Amherst case, which was recently settled out of court. He says that the lawsuit arose out of a sexual assault complaint filed by an Amherst student 18 months after the assault was alleged to have occurred. The complainant claimed that she was forced to perform sexual acts, so the college conducted an investigation and held a disciplinary hearing before three administrators before expelling the accused student. But the hearing failed to include key evidence suggesting the complaint was false, so the accused student sued the university and federal court. As an aside, it's interesting to me to consider, why would a woman falsely accuse a man of sexual assault? And the reasons are kind of interesting. So if we continue with this article, it says the controversy over the investigation is focused mostly on a string of text messages that the accuser sent the night of the incident. They suggest that she had initiated the sexual encounter, and now she was in search of a good lie to avoid fallout for having hooked up with the accused student, her roommate's boyfriend. So she realized she'd done something that was going to get her potentially in a lot of trouble. So she was trying to explain her behavior in some other way than admitting that she'd had sex with somebody that in a committed relationship she supposedly shouldn't have had. So initially she denied sending the texts, but however at other times, she twice admitted that she had sent them, but none of the panel members asked her to address the contradiction. The student who was accused learned of the texts, but the college said he'd found them too late in their process. And the college said something quite strange, that they had only sought texts indicating that the incident had been non-consensual, which seems clear evidence of bias, that they were looking for evidence that sexual assault had happened and not looking for evidence and seeing whether it supported that contention or supported the contention that the incident had actually been consensual. Another thing the college did was to deny the accused and his lawyer the opportunity to directly cross-examine the accuser. The problem with using the 50% plus a little bit preponderance of evidence standard is that when sued, they're going to use a higher standard and the college is going to lose. But I guess what they're really concerned about is losing government funding, more concerned than actually losing these lawsuits. Emily Yaffe has written some good stuff on the problems with campus sexual assault investigations. One of her articles, she's now writing for The Atlantic, The Bad Science Behind Campus Response to Sexual Assault. She describes A woman named Rebecca Campbell, who's a professor of psychology at Michigan State, who teaches the science of trauma. She believes that sexual assault accusers are so traumatized by the events that they have difficulty recalling what happened. She has acknowledged, according to Yaffe, that she is not a neuroscientist, but she uses other people's work. Her major message is for a sexual assault victim to reconstruct what happened requires a sympathetic questioner who will give the victim the time and space to resemble what she calls little post-it notes in a coherent order. She assured her audience, this was from a 2012 talk, that the story that emerges will be a true account of the crime. What we know from the research is that the laying down of that memory is accurate and the recall of it is accurate. This sounds a lot like the recovered memory phenomenon, where people would go to a counselor and over time out would come a story of sexual abuse when they were an infant or a child. And in some cases, people went to jail based on this so-called recovered memory. It's now believed by most people to be fraudulent. As a counter, Yaffe talked with Richard McNally, a psychology professor at Harvard, who has studied trauma on memory. He has written, "Neuroscience research does not support the claim that high levels of stress hormones impair memory for traumatic experience. In fact, it's almost the opposite. Extreme stress enhances memory for the central aspects of an overwhelming emotional experience." It makes sense, McNally says, for natural selection to favor the memory of trauma. If you remember life-threatening situations, you're more likely to avoid them. Notably, survivors of recent horrific events, the Aurora movie theater massacre, San Bernardino terror attack, Orlando nightclub mass murder, have at trial or in interviews given narrative accounts of their ordeals that are chronological, coherent, detailed, and lucid. She also quotes Elizabeth Loftus, a professor of psychology and social behavior at UC Irvine, who's worked on memory manipulation. She said that during the recovered memory scare of the 1980s and 90s, thousands of people were convinced by their therapists and by best-selling books on the subject that their problems were caused by repressed memories of childhood sexual abuse, often at the hands of their father. Theory was that the mind buried what had happened because it was so awful, but that the forgotten events could have caused a lifetime of pain, and guided by therapists, victims could recover them. But it now appears the therapists were able to implant false memories, resulting in baseless accusations that tore families apart. This was eventually discredited. Loftus also talked to Yaffe about the effects of drinking on memory. She said that with alcohol-induced memory fragmentation, attempts to reconstruct events are very vulnerable to post-event suggestion. This can include someone, especially an authority figure, labeling a consensual act as rape. She said it's then easy for exaggerated or even entirely false memories to be created, ones that feel completely real. "This is extremely worrisome," she told me. "The universities are under enormous pressure to do something about sexual assault, and they sometimes fill these offices with people whose bias and agendas lead them to create victimhood." But Title IX investigations have not been restricted to accusations of sexual assault. Only in 2015, not that long ago, Laura Kipnis, a film studies professor at Northwestern University, according to an article in The New Yorker, talked about, well, she wrote an article entitled "Sexual Paranoia Strikes Academe." She wrote about the case of Peter Ludlow, who was disciplined for sexual harassment by Title IX, and she questioned the logic of the accusations against him, which is an academic position. Maybe she's right, maybe she's wrong. Well, one of the people who had accused Ludlow, a graduate student who was not named in Kipnis' essay, then joined a fellow graduate student in the philosophy department in filing Title IX complaints against Kipnis. She claimed that Kipnis was engaging in retaliation. And so Kipnis got stuck in a circle of Title IX, what she calls Title IX inquisitions. So clearly, Title IX was being used to punish something for, clearly, in the case of Kipnis, there were no allegations of sexual assault. She had just indicated concerns about a Title IX investigation, and that triggered a Title IX investigation, and then another. Kipnis has published a couple of books, and the graduate student who has apparently filed 6 Title IX complaints has sued her for what she claims are false statements in the book. One of the statements that she's suing about is the fact that she's described as a serial Title IX filer. But I think any student who's filed 6 Title IX complaints can be described accurately as a serial Title IX filer. Kipnis said, "These complaints against me seem like an attempt to bend the campus judicial system to punish someone whose work involves questioning the campus judicial system, such as bringing Title IX complaints over my first Chronicle essay attempt to do 2 years ago. The process is the punishment." So I do sort of feel a little bit guilty in saying something nice about Betsy DeVos, because as I said earlier, I think overall she was a terrible choice for the Department of Education, but it's really become quite clear that these Title IX investigations have gone too far, and it's not justice. It's also claimed by some people that there is an epidemic of sexual assault on campuses, and that, as an article in the Emory Wheel said, this has been cited many times, the rate of falsely reported rapes is only between 2% and 10%. That's actually the rate of provably false. And as is should be obvious to anybody, in the case of sexual assault, if there's only 2 people in the room when it occurs, it's very difficult to prove whether the allegations are true or false. So provably false is different from whether something is really false or not. So the rate of false reports could be more than 10%, but even if it was only between 2 and 10%, considering the consequences, it's still a significant number. And it's even if it was only 1%, it would still mean that justice is needed for that 1% of people who were falsely accused. It's not clear that this is any worse on campuses than anywhere else. Of course, there are a lot of parents who are very concerned. They send their well-looked-after child, well-protected child to university for the first time, at the first time they've been away from home. And the parents probably have a lot of suspicions that their child is going to experiment with sex, drugs, and alcohol. Those suspicions are not unfounded. So it's easy for them to believe that they've now gone into this environment where there are a man on every corner who want to rape their daughters. There are some, but that is true in work environments, in the military, in many other places as well. And in general, we have a police force to deal with these things, and that's where this should be dealt with. And if the police forces are not doing a good job, that should be changed, so that if there is a rape amongst a woman working minimum wage at Walmart, or between a woman who's a graduate student at Harvard, they should be investigated with the same desire to find the truth, using good standards of evidence that are necessary in a criminal case. And if a man did rape a woman on campus and never graduates from college and never gets that great job that they wanted, I don't have a lot of sympathy. But we have to have sympathy for the possibility that somebody may be falsely accused. I will put links to some of these articles in the show notes. I hope you will read some of the great articles that I quoted from. And think about it, and let me know what you think about the issues of guns and also Title IX and sexual assault on campuses. Thank you for listening to episode 157 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.